Greetings, everyone. We're back with yet another episode in season 2 of the CoverCast podcast. This podcast is an initiative of the Cover Project and is co-hosted by myself, Penina Achayo-Laker, and my friend and colleague, John Inazu. John and I are both faculty at Washington University in St. Louis and also fellows with the Cover Project. Our hope with this podcast is to engage with Christian faculty in higher education through highlighting their scholarship, their research, their teaching, and service to bridge those connections between university, church, and society. Today, we are honored and excited to spend some time talking
with
Jen.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Jen, welcome to the CoverCast podcast.
Jen, it's great to have you with us. Philosopher at South Carolina, we're going to want to hear from you some of what you do, but I want to actually start with, we met just a few weeks ago out in California, which felt like a different time of the world, I guess. But I was struck by the way that you spoke about combining teaching with mentoring students and the relationships that form, not just while they're there, but, you know, for the rest of their lives. And so could you start off? We'll get to the work stuff in a minute, but can you start off by telling us a little bit about your vision for being an educator who not just teaches,
so
but invests in the lives of your students?
I was really pleased to be asked to talk about that in front of a group of professors and deans. I mean, for me, it just goes back to my own experience. I am someone who kind of lacked mentors in at times and places in my life where I needed them the most. And, but then again, you know, there were also times, especially early on in undergrad, where I felt like I did have good mentors. And so I've always just kept in mind, the need for that, the need to be able to look up to someone, as a source of aspiration and imitation in the intellectual life, you know, but even more broadly, you know, in a human life, in a good flourishing human life, we need to have people that we feel like are good role models, but also people who take an active interest in us. And so I've always tried, insofar as I can, you know, to make that a part of my intellectual life. And I think that it would be nice if our universities and our institutions of higher education had models that, had models for us that kind of encouraged that more integrated form of life, right? Where it's not just research and teaching, but teaching and mentoring, you know, seeing it as all part of the same intellectual life, seeing it as the center of, you know, the actual mission of a university.
Right. Yeah. Wow. And I mean, as you were talking, I was thinking the challenge for us as Christian faculty is, especially, you know, quite frankly, at institutions that don't value that and are not going to incentivize it, is to ask whether we can enable flourishing within fundamentally broken institutions that are not going to change, right?
And so, yeah, I mean, I think that it's hugely important
anyway,
because the truth is that, you know, there are a lot of Christian students in these universities. But even more than that, there are a lot of students who are just searching. You know, when I was a freshman, I wasn't a Christian, but I just was someone who was desperately searching for something, right? Something that made sense, something that was meaningful, something that I thought was important and true and good. And, you know, that's just a very human thing. And I think that, you know, Christian professors in particular need to take that seriously, you know, that regardless of their faith commitments, our students are human beings who are looking for some kind of fundamental story, some kind of meaning that they can make out of their own lives. And that we have to try to help them do that too. I mean, as a philosopher, maybe there's like a special burden on me for the whole meaning of life stuff. But I think, you know, it's just part of, well, it ought to be part of higher education that we are helping students to make sense of themselves, to make sense of their lives, to make sense of their place.
Yeah, I imagine, you know, a lot of that involves being vulnerable. And it's, as you said, in that teacher-student relationship, to do it well and to do it authentically comes with you sort of putting yourself out there a little bit. What have you found to be either some challenges as you have navigated?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's always the time challenge, and I think you just have to bite that bullet and make the time. But then I also think, you know, with young people, they don't necessarily understand boundaries. And so you have to, you know, and especially with technology, it's like, you know, you have to be like, okay, well, you can't text me in the middle of the night. Like, that's not, that's like not appropriate. And right. I have had some students who, you know, it became clear at some point that they needed help that I could not give them. And so, you know, you have to recognize what those limits are and to try to refer them to support systems, you know, that they need. There have definitely been some students where I realized, like, you have a very significant mental health issue or maybe an issue with addiction or whatever. And yeah, it is part of my job to get you the help you need, perhaps even if you don't want it. I at least have to point you in that direction. And I have had students who were incredibly grateful, you know, for me for doing that as well. So I think, you know, any human relationship can go poorly, and you just have to, and any human relationship involves a certain kind of vulnerability. But I just think obviously the teacher-student relationship is a human relationship and has to be understood in its complete human dimension.
I was just going to add to that a little bit, Jen, because I think, you know, as you're talking, I'm reflecting on just like this stage in my life where, you know, as a, you know, a newer mom, but also, you know, kind of still navigating my academic career and still being a junior faculty member, how mentorship becomes so critical in all those facets of life. And, you know, we don't all seek, I feel like we always all need some kind of mentorship or at least some kind of relationship where there is someone else that you could look to that perhaps has navigated what you're navigating before. And I imagine, and I would like to think that by virtue of the fact that we ourselves crave and maybe see value in that, that, you know, it's only right that, you know, we in turn
absolutely
kind of give that back in some way too.
Jen, I was going to ask you on, you know, you mentioned a minute ago that maybe there's a special burden on philosophers to think through questions about the meaning of life. And I mean, I was thinking that, I thought maybe, but also maybe it depends on what kind of philosopher you are. So I think, you know, you do work, among other things, on Aristotle and Aquinas. Those guys are going to get you to the meaning of life questions. But I wonder, do you encounter within your profession the kind of honest philosopher who arrives at a very different conclusion and then maybe says there's not much to teach about the meaning of life or certain versions of the good life? I mean, one of the things I admire about some of the more rigorous philosophical thinkers is they sometimes tease out the implications of their premises, even when they go to very dark places. And to me, the opportunity there is an opportunity to contrast that with Christian hope in a frame that
you know, in the world of professional philosophy, you'll find just about everything. Although, so you'll find just about every view out there. But there are a lot of statistical commonalities. So, for example, English-speaking analytic philosophers, like 92% of them are atheists, for example. And similar numbers for materialists, naturalists, right? So they are sort of committed to a very immanent picture of the universe. And so, of course, that gets reflected in how philosophy is taught. And I do think that when philosophers teach courses on the meaning of life, or when they get into sort of meaning in life questions, they will tend to teach a wide variety of views. I don't know how often they will teach, you know, Christian views about hope or meaning. I do feel a kind of special burden, I guess, as a Christian philosopher, to remind people or to speak about the fact that, there's Camus, but there's also St. Augustine. there's also, a huge tradition of thinking that not only is meaningfulness and purposiveness intelligible, but it's actually necessary, right? That if we rip it out of the heart of things, we lose a lot of aspects of rational intelligibility that philosophers really like and want to hang on to. And so I think that, when I teach this stuff, which I very often do, I teach everything from Camus to Boethius, and it's really fun. It's really fun to talk about this stuff with students. And a lot of students will end up in my office with some very hard questions. And when they ask me what I think, I will tell them, but I'm really just there as a philosopher, like trying to help them understand what they're saying and to tease out the implications of what they're saying, they definitely need help teasing out. But it's an interesting process, like, and you never really know where this stuff is coming from. So for example, in the spring, I was teaching a class on constitutional law, and it was like a First Amendment class. And it was really just a lot of religious liberty cases. And then this one student, about three quarters of the way into the semester, is like, I really need to talk to you. Like, can we find time to talk? And I'm like, sure. And he just wanted to talk about whether or not God existed. and what the arguments would be. And I'm like, do this. Wanted to know what theology was. And then I checked in with this guy like a couple months later, and he was baptized. So I don't know. That was pretty wild.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no kidding. Wow. Hey, on the subject of your discipline of philosophy, and maybe to zoom out a bit and for a more general audience, describe it in some broad strokes. But I wonder if you can comment. I mean, I think probably most people outside of the philosophy world don't understand the dominance of analytic philosophy in Western philosophy departments and what that has meant for education in liberal arts colleges. But then a related intriguing strand for me is the resurgence of Christian philosophers, sort of a past generation of Nick Walterstorff, Al Plantinga, Eleanor Stump, and others, and then many of their students and Catholic philosophers as well, other Catholic philosophers. So I'm intrigued maybe to get an insider's perspective from you of what the discipline is like, some of its opportunities, some of its challenges, how you see the future of philosophy, really within a humanities framework that I am finding increasingly incoherent.
I don't really know what the future of philosophy is going to be, especially within the university. So I just wrote an essay on this for The Point magazine. Things look pretty grim. Philosophy departments are closing. Philosophy departments are not getting new hires. PhDs in philosophy, find themselves in a position where there are no jobs. And so it, I think, you know, the trends in higher education are really worrying if you're in the humanities, but especially if you're in philosophy. And so what the future of philosophy is, I think, is really tied to the future of the humanities in the university. And that's tied to the university's self-conception. And the more the university becomes like a trade school, I think the less likely it is that philosophy and the humanities are going to do very well or even survive within it. But I would say that, you know, as philosophy goes today, I mean, I'm an analytic philosopher. I did my undergrad at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, and that department was very analytic, but it was also very historical. So I got a, it would never call itself like a great books program, but I got a very great booksy kind of introduction to philosophy, you know, and I'm extremely grateful for that. And you know, then I did my PhD at an analytic philosophy program. But it was a place that was very hospitable to the Aristotelian tradition. And so for me, it wasn't that much of a stretch to be in a philosophy department where there were no believers, so that there were no Christian philosophers in my department. But I wrote my dissertation on Aquinas and Philip of Foot and Elizabeth Anscombe. And, you know, everybody kind of was like, yeah, that's cool, whatever. It's a little bit weird, but Aquinas is interesting. And you know, everybody knew that I was Catholic and, you know, they thought it was a little strange, but whatever. it's like, it was fine. There is a whole wing of analytic philosophy that kind of gets called analytic philosophy of religion. There was no one in my department who did that. And I don't really do that myself. I don't think many people would call me a philosopher of religion. I just do philosophy and I draw on sources from the tradition, including many Christian thinkers like Augustine and Aquinas and Boethius, etc.
Jen, I'm curious about what you have observed in your career about how students are arriving at studying philosophy. You shared a really great example about the one student in your class who just really wanted to understand who God was, for example. How are students arriving at this?
The students who end up in my office and really want to talk, right? You know, these are students who have a lot of existential questions. You know, maybe they, for the first time, are questioning their faith and whether or not they can really believe it. Maybe they're questioning a lot of the stuff they heard at their student life intake stuff. I get a lot of students like kind of freaking out about their student life, you know, introductory seminars, which were mandatory. I get a lot of students that want to talk about gender and marriage and stuff like this. I think a lot of students know that I'm a Christian. And so they're like, okay, you know, let me go talk to her and see what's going on. But I get all kinds of questions from all kinds of people because I'm at a very large state school and there's just, I mean, that's real diversity. this isn't like the cultivated boutique diversity. It's like the real deal here. And I love it, you know, I never really know who is going to walk into my office or what they're going to want to talk about. But as a philosopher, I'm kind of trained to be open to talking about anything and to trying to help them sort of get to the bottom of things. And, you know, I think one of the things that I realized maybe in the past 5 years in particular is that it's okay for me to tell them where I'm coming from, so long as I communicate it in a way that isn't threatening and doesn't shut down the conversation. So it's like, you know, okay, well, this is, you know, this is my point of view, but let's talk about what you think and we can have an actual dialogue. But I find it very difficult to have a dialogue with students unless you're upfront about where you're coming from, because they want to know. You know, they want to know and they want to feel like some kind of authentic exchange is happening. And it's not happening if it's just a kind of formal dialectical thing. They want something more like a, not like a heart to heart. That's like a little bit too intense or personal, but something personal. They want some kind of personal exchange and to feel like something happened that mattered.
Yeah, right. And I think also there's a tension because some students come in with this sense, and even some of our colleagues have a sense of being able to be neutral in the classroom. And I just don't think there's a neutrality, right? There's a responsible way to teach good reasoning and to teach empathetic readings and to understand the other side of an argument. But it's not like any of us are coming in, you know, as disembodied people or without any viewpoints on this stuff. And I find teaching law classes, I try to tell my students, I do have views on lots of these things, but I want you, my goal for you is to understand the best sides on both sides of an argument and then argue it well, but not to lose my own.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that was something that it took me a little while to come around to, because I used to be very sold on the idea that I was a neutral arbiter of ideas. And I've just come to, one, find that hopeless. Like, I just can't, it turns out I just can't do it. But two, it's not an effective way to teach. You know, something's at stake for everybody. It's best to be honest about it. Yeah,
right.
That's right.
Not effective and not authentic.
I think that the biggest thing that I strive to cultivate, especially in a philosophy class, is a sense of, you know, openness and respect. Like, I will hear you out, but only if you communicate it in a respectful way.
I'm curious if you have not only a favorite class, but a specific sort of point in your students' college education where you enjoy to teach them. So, you know, when they're either freshmen coming in fresh out of high school or when they're sort of more, you know, informed in their opinions.
I really love teaching
freshmen and things like that,
because I feel like a lot of it ends up being remedial. I like teaching, I like teaching upper level classes where we can really get into something. And at any rate, that tends to be, for a variety of reasons, that tends to be the only sort of class that I teach at this point. I'm also a person who tends to constantly be changing my classes because I get bored. You know, like, I don't want to teach the same class over and over again. I'm sort of constantly mixing it up. I just had an amazing time teaching this class on constitutional law. Like, it was outside my wheelhouse. I just kind of threw myself into it. And it just actually turns out that there are all sorts of philosophical issues there. And it was really fun. And the students were really, really into it. And most of them were not philosophers, right? Most of the kids in that class were coming from political theory or history or something like that. And So in a way, it was sort of like an intro to philosophy class without being an intro to philosophy class. And so let me teach you philosophy by doing it. And yeah, it was just so much fun. So much fun.
I mean, yeah, now you're speaking my love language here with con law. So tell me, give us some of the takeaways. Like what were some of the surprising connections you saw?
The First Amendment's like a real mess. that was one takeaway. I guess for me, what was so fun about that class is that it really forces you to do history and philosophy together, you know, so you sort of can't look at it. You can't look at this as like just a set of arguments, right? And it would be terrible to do that. Like you have to understand the historical context and the way things are shifting and changing. And yeah, I mean, I just came away from it with incredibly different opinions than when I went into it. So I felt like it was a good philosophy class because it completely changed my mind by doing philosophy. And I think it was that way for a lot of the students. And yeah, I mean, I don't really know. I'm not sure that I came away thinking, oh yeah, this is the correct view. I sort of came away thinking like, this is really a mess. How are we going to get out of this mess?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think to me, I mean, it's interesting that you approach this topic as a philosopher, because to me, the most coherent way to make sense of constitutional interpretation is as an argument and a practice in the McIntyrian sense. And if it's not that, then I'm really not sure what it is.
I mean, it would be really fun to talk about it sometime in a different context. But it was my first time teaching it. It was just kind of getting my feet wet. But it was a lot of fun. Yeah.
That's awesome. Let's talk about sort of ministry work as a faculty member. I mean, when you and I were together, you were telling me some about the work of the Thomistic Institute and your partnership there. I'm guessing probably most of the people listening to this podcast might be less familiar with the Thomistic Institute. So could you tell us a little bit about their work and your partnership with them and sort of how you see your role on campus through the lens of a ministry partner?
Yeah, so the Thomistic Institute is run by the Dominicans in Washington, D.C., so the Dominicans of the Eastern Province in the United States. And, you know, they basically have student chapters. I think now it's 65 schools across the country. And these student chapters are student-led with a faculty sponsor. So I'm the faculty sponsor of our student chapter of the Thomistic Institute here. And the Thomistic Institute exists to bring, you know, Catholic Christian wisdom to college campuses. We focus on philosophy and theology talks, reading groups. You know, my chapter has had, in addition to all sorts of philosophy and theology talks on campus, we've had reading groups on Dante, on Flannery O'Connor, on Graham Greene. We've had theology reading groups. But of course, it is centered around the thought of Thomas Aquinas. It is the Dominicans that we're talking about. And I've been with the Thomistic Institute since 2016, when they had this idea that they were going to start campus chapters. And they asked me to be on board. And I said, yeah, absolutely. Our chapter was one of the first chapters. And it's just been incredibly successful. And it's been a real blessing for me and for my family, because we have grown very close to the students in our chapter, who are kind of always coming in and out of the house. We live really close to campus, so it's very easy for students to come find me, and that was kind of by design. And yeah, it's really nice to see students who are really interested in integrating their faith and the intellectual life that they have at the university. And the Thomistic Institute is one way for them to do that. I think a lot of campus ministry is really not integrated to the life of study. And the Thomistic Institute is about the life of study and about integrating the life of study with the faith. And so I absolutely love it. It just brings me a lot of joy and happiness.
Wow. I imagine being at a big school, a state school, students appreciate being able to have that closer contact with faculty while talking about, you know, faith and scholarship and things like that. That's really great. We, through the Carver Project, have these reading groups that we started doing, and a colleague of mine in the art school, John Hendricks, runs one for art students, and we're going to be starting, I think, second year of doing this. And it's been humbling for me to just see how calm, how normal, how human, how exciting it is when we are with students in those spaces where we can, you know, we have a book that we read every semester. And it's, sometimes I feel like we forget that for students, mm-hmm. It's the little things that really make a difference or matter in their lives. And I imagine, you know, some of the work you're doing through the Institute is giving students that opportunity to just be, to be human, to find meaning in what they're doing, to connect, to get mentorship.
Yeah, and I mean, it's been really great because, again, it's sort of right at the intersection of the life of study and the faith, and explicitly trying to show how they are connected, right? That this thirst, this desire mm-hmm. that we have to know and to understand is leading you somewhere in particular, right? And that the thing that is going to completely satisfy that desire is God, right? How are we to understand that? How are we to see mm-hmm. our study as something drawing us into closer relationship with God? Why does philosophy and theology matter at all? I mean, mm-hmm. I think a lot of Christians don't have an answer to that question. And I think that's very unfortunate because in our tradition, mm-hmm. you know, they always mattered. So we need to recover the sense that it matters, and that it matters in particular to the life of study. Oh gosh.
I love that. I love that. Last question, Twitter and the good life. So you are a busy person. You're teaching, you're doing a lot of public speaking, you're researching, you have a family and young kids, and you're active not only on Twitter, but that subset of Twitter that's Catholic Twitter. So I wonder if you can reflect,
it's okay.
This is maybe a bad closing question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Reflect a bit on your sense of what social media is doing to us and maybe ups and downs to it.
Yeah, I sort of feel like at this point, for me, social media is a necessary evil, and I'm not sure what to do about that, right? Because if it's really evil, then it shouldn't be necessary. Let me start with why I think it's bad. So I think the worst part about social media is its demands on our attention, right? So I think that our capacity to pay attention is a spiritual capacity. And I constantly find myself just lost on Twitter. I don't even know why I'm there, arguing with some avatar. I mean, who knows who this person is? And I'm like, what am I doing? You know, like, there are things worthy of my attention right now, and this is not it, right? But social media has this, and this is empirically demonstrated, it has this kind of addictive quality to it. And I think that, you know, I'm very glad that I did not grow up with social media, with the internet, because it really is addictive, especially at an early age. And what I see in my children is an inability to pay attention, right? So I was at the National Gallery this summer with my daughter, trying to like contemplate art together. And she was like, "Mom, I can't look at anything for more than 20 seconds. Like, I just literally can't." And I think, you know, that's a little bit scary to me, because without this ability to really pay attention and to contemplate, then we can't really pray, right? We can't really be wise. And I think we also can't really be good. And so I worry a lot about this capture of our attention. And I worry about it for my kids. I worry about it for myself. On the other hand, you know, Twitter has been great for me in a lot of ways. I've met so many amazing people on Twitter. You know, for every crazy person out there, I've met someone really, really interesting and insightful. And of course, there have been a lot of opportunities for me online, especially as a writer. Twitter's great, right? Because you get, you get a lot of instant feedback, some good, some bad, but it's just a very large platform. And so I think there's a lot of good there, but there's also a lot of potential for evil, and that we just have to be very, very careful about our attention as a resource. And that we have to not let ourselves, we have to be especially attentive to the ways that our attention gets drained away and we get distracted from what really deserves our attention. And I think a lot of Twitter doesn't deserve our attention. I really wish that I could better filter out the good and the bad on Twitter. With respect to Catholic Twitter in particular, you know, it's very draining. Catholics, like most Americans, are just very divided, and I think very addicted to being divided. And so it can get very nasty, and I really have to keep reminding myself not to get too involved in that. Which isn't to say that I haven't. And of course, I've made a lot of mistakes online. You got to be careful out there. Mm-hmm. And I also can say a lot of my students are watching me online. I'm constantly reminding myself that, you know, okay, Twitter isn't real life, but in a sense it is. And what I say on Twitter, you know, my students see, so it matters that I try to model civility and, you know, insofar as one can be virtuous on Twitter, you know, I try to be. And of course I fail, but I try to be. We are all human, right. And I definitely have had very bad days on Twitter.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Jen, for taking the time to talk with us today. I really appreciated your openness, your honesty. Definitely walking away with a lot of insights about life, meaning, philosophy, what philosophers do, the things they talk about. But such great points and reminders there too for how we should be engaging with social media in this day and age.
No problem.
It's really important. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Jen.